mapping magnetic resonance into qubits and seeing where it takes us. I'm going to remind you once again of David DiVincenzo's criteria, which says it's time to get a little bit shorter, that we have a scalable map. So you remember that we need to initialize. We need to have gates. We need to control errors. And we need to be able to make a qubit-specific measurement. And when we looked at magnetic resonance, we said that for a single qubit, for a single spin, we could describe the dynamics of the system in terms of the block equations, which describe the dynamics for any two-level system. And they would have three components to them. One component would be, I always have to think about the signs. One component would be a precessional term that mixes x and y. And the way we have it is that x rotates into y, so it's like so. And this is a rotation about the z-axis, of course. And then there's a nutational term. And if I put the RF field along the x-axis, we don't need to. It can be along any axis in the transverse plane, but conveniently along the x-axis. Then that would mix the y and z components. And again, I have to think that that's positive, so this is negative. And then there's relaxation terms that take us back towards equilibrium. And there are two time constants for that, T1, which is an energy exchange mechanism, and T2, which is a decoherence. And there's an equilibrium magnetization. And since the system has energy defined about the z-axis, that the equilibrium state only appears along z. Yeah? Yeah.
Do we get any advantage by putting the RF frequency in 90 degrees to the z-axis rather than at a different angle? I guess
it is essential, right? Because I have the states here, and I want to introduce a precession. Remember that spin one half system. So the only thing that can happen in a spin one half system is that we have a torque from another magnetic field that builds dynamics of a spin one half system. So if I want to go from 0 to 1, then necessarily I need to be in the transverse field. Now, the other thing that you can see, of course, is that if I have a field that is along z, then that field only couples in as a DC field. Right, that it's only the DC part of that field which is going to lead to some evolution. So if I say, fine, I will put a radio frequency field tilted out of that plane, and I will now apply this field as a radio frequency field here, then I'll leave it for you, but it's easy to show that it's only the components of that field along the transverse direction which is going to cause transition. So this would effectively scale the strength of that field by cosine of theta. Because the piece that is along the z-axis, remember that this field is a radio frequency field, so it's rotating, it's modulating. And that piece of it is going to be averaged out over time. The only reason that this piece remains is that in the rotating frame, that becomes a static field. So if I said, oh yeah, I have this field here, and you know, how would we draw this field? So we would say that we have some amplitude along sigma x, I'll try to remember to put it back to 2, that it's going to rotate about that field. But before I rotate it about the field, I'm going to tilt this up in the field. So I'm going to say that, oh yeah, we'll take this and we'll tilt it so it becomes omega 1 over 2 cosine theta sigma x plus sine theta sigma z, right? And then we're going to take this, we're going to rotate it, but we're rotating it about the z-axis, so we'll have a term that goes e to the I omega t over 2 times t sigma z. Put a negative sign there, and I'll have its Hermitian conjugate here, right? Now, of course, these are going to lead to a modulation of sigma x, right? They're not going to do anything for here, okay? And then go through the whole process, and you'll see at the end, this dependence is going to remain, and you end up losing that, okay? So having an RF field, the only piece of it that couples in is the piece along the XY axis. Okay, so we have, yeah.
This is, I guess, a little off topic, but like, I just want to make sure I understand this thing.
So sure.
You have a fixed spin, which is, like, you turn on a strong magnetic field, and you have these spins aligned along the Z-axis, presumably. Mm-hmm. And then you turn on like the small transverse field.
Yeah.
And now the spins are aligned slightly off of the field, so they start processing around the field, right?
Yeah. So if you think about this in a laboratory frame, as you're trying to do here, and you say that I have I have a spin. So well, let's just keep the complex these. Small. I have a magnetization. Remember that of course, the spin does not align along this field. You know, I've completely neglected that.
Okay.
Right? But you know, the spin is aligned in a cone.
Oh.
Right? Because well, you can only specify the length of the vector in one component of it. Right? And so because I can define the length of the vector in one component, we have a cone of spins. And there's no preferred direction in the xy plane. And so, and of course, I have two cones because I have a Boltzmann distribution. But this cone is slightly more populated, and the spins are evenly distributed about the cone. So it ends up that the net magnetization vector, and the only thing we care about, is oriented along z. Then, as you said, we've got some field. So let's have another coordinate system here for the field. We have some field, which is V0 here. And let's take it as a rotating field. So now I have a component, a very small component, here relative to V0 that's rotating at some frequency omega naught. And this is going to wobble around that effective field, which is rotating, it'll always be a torque. And so you can calculate that dynamic. It's pretty easy, actually, to integrate. You can use the Planck equation integrator I gave you. And you can see that the complex pattern. Because we have this is simple motion, however, we can say, fine, let's just remove that precessional term from it. And go into a rotating frame. So here we say, okay, let's go to a rotating frame. If I go to a rotating frame, and in this case, I said the rotation was exactly omega naught. So in the rotating frame, there's a field that we introduced by transforming to the rotating frame that exactly cancels out that V0 field. You know, that happens classically in quantum mechanics. And we're left with just
this DC field.
Okay.
And now that, of course, leads to a precession. And so you can see exactly what this would be. You say, okay, I have this rotation. If I went back up here, I need to add that precession. And so there would be a motion like that in the laboratory frame. Yeah?
Is it easy to see what happens to the spin when we go to the rotating frame?
In the rotating frame, the spin just goes like this. Right? I have a field. The only thing that happens.
So we have, like, pick one of our spins at random, right?
Yeah.
And it has a density matrix, like with like the cone that you drew on the board.
Okay. So I have this cone, right? I worry a little bit about, you know, if you say you have a density matrix of one spin, then you say, okay, I have a density matrix that I'm going to describe this ensemble
right.
over. And that would describe just this piece here. For if I could label any spin, then I could have a spin somewhere on this cone. And would it go exactly with the same motion? Right? It's always, you know, regardless of which isochrome mass one would choose, it's always going to just be a torque about the magnetic field. Right, so the only motion is always is going to be this torque. Remember that quantum mechanics is linear. So the fact that I can add the magnetization the moments for this ensemble, get a bulk magnetization, describe the motion of that solution works. That is valid for every element of the ensemble because you know we still have linearity to go backwards. And so for this component, then if I went to take that component, go to the rotating frame. Go to the rotating frame. Right in this lab frame, this is rotating at omega naught, the whole cutoffs. I go to the rotating frame. And now we would still have that cone, except it would be static. And I would apply my RF field here.
Okay.
And it would process, right? And so effectively, what I would end up doing for a 90-degree pulse is putting that cone here.
Okay, so the spin eigenstates for in the lab frame are spin up and some rotating spin along the xy plane, and then
the spin eigenstates. Are spin up and spin down. Right, we're calculating the dynamics by moving to the interaction frame. We're not really quantizing the system.
Right. Okay. Sorry.
All of
so
this is
okay.
A similarity transform.
So a basis of eigenstates is up and down in the rotating frame, and
yep.
Up and down are just things that are rotationally invariant under that rotation. So when you go to the rotating frame, the eigenstates are still up and down. Sorry, did I say rotating frame? In the lab frame, the eigenstates
in,
are up and
in
down.
Both.
In both. Both. Okay. Okay.
Okay. Good. So over here. As we just said, we saw that there's an initial state, which is the deviation part of the density matrix looks like the sum over this. If, so I'm going to call that deviation. If we looked at the full density matrix, then of course we have an identity term, and the term in front of this, h bar omega naught over kt, should be a negative sign, summation, sigma z, so I, this term is about 10 to the minus 5, and so it's very weakly polarized. And we're going to detect the signal over some large numbers of spins, and so it will be justified in just thinking about that magnetic flow. So if we looked over here, we've got the map. We have the initialization, but it's not sufficient. We can initialize. We have gates. You looked at the universality condition, or you will. We have measurement. We're going to look at errors today. And what we'll see is that we have all of the tools to demonstrate the dynamics that we expect for a quantum computer, but we don't have the scaling laws that would allow us to build an efficient quantum computer. So that we've been careful, usually we call this a quantum information processor. Now, I want to look at some of these errors. We saw when we looked at initialization that what we needed for a quantum computer, so the quantum computer, the initial state, let's just think about it as 2 qubits for now. This is state 0, 0, which we could write out in terms of an operator. So we've been writing it as a projector, so we can write it as an operator. Has that structure. And these two don't share a common eigenvalue, so we needed a nonlinear process. We introduced a nonlinear process, which was a magnetic field gradient. We're going to look at that a little bit more. But it's a general scheme, it's a general rule as we apply gates in any version of quantum computing that we end up with traces of those gates written into the system because noise is slowly varying. So if I have a superconducting system, then what I find is that I end up having slightly different Rabi fields every time I try to interact with the qubit, or I have slightly different Ramsey fringes. And remember that the Rabi is measuring omega 1. Yeah. Okay, and so the first thing that we have for controlling gates is to make the gate sequence more complex. This is an old idea worth looking at. So if I'd like to apply rotation, let's say about the x-axis, and I start off with the equilibrium magnetization, so the spin, just one spin now, pointed along the z direction, and we're going to apply a rotation about this axis, and what it should do, so this is this row 0, and this is our RF field. Now, what it should do is it should rotate through pi to end up at exactly the negative z direction. But you can see that any error that takes us out of the xy plane will not overlap with the minus z direction because we'll be rotating in a cone, right? So there's only one cone that takes plus z to minus z. Right, and that's where the rotation axis is exactly in the xy plane. Also, of course, if the amplitude or time is just slightly off, we will not achieve, we will not have this effective rotation. We'll end up somewhere close to, hopefully, but not at the minus z direction. And so we can take this pulse, and I can say, well, in reality, what this is going to look like is something that's not quite right. It's going to look like a pulse with some error. And then I can replace this.
replace it with three pulses that have an error, the same error that we had here. So here we had an error at epsilon for 180-degree rotation. So to be fair, I'll take an error at epsilon over 2 for a pi rotation, pi over 2 rotation, and keep the error at epsilon for pi rotation. Okay. And now let's look at what we've accomplished. Seems like very little, because it's a more complicated sequence. Yeah?
Would that be pi over 2 minus epsilon over 2?
Yes, it would be. Thanks.
What were you, if I could revisit, what did you mean by an error taken out of xy plane? Because
it does. Right, if I have a rotation
so
axis.
You mean the okay, so the axis is not the same.
No. X out of the yz plane.
Oh, okay, I misheard you.
Yeah?
Sorry.
Well, I maybe misspoke, but that was the point. So anyway, so ideally it should keep us in the yz plane. We tilt it up, we get the.
Yeah.
Okay. So now let's look at this. I'm going to put the x-axis here, the y-axis there, just to be convenient. The first rotation says that we don't quite get to the y-axis, right? So we're rotating from the initial state. And we get somewhere close to the y-axis with some angle, some error, epsilon over 2. The second rotation is about the y-axis. And it's a rotation of almost pi. And so we go through almost 180 degrees. About the y-axis. And then the third rotation takes us close to the z-axis. And if you look at the mathematical notebook I gave you, I calculate for you, you can do it yourself, of course, how close you get to the y-axis. For here, you'll find that for a range of errors, it takes you quite close to the y-axis. And we get an improvement in the performance of the gate without having, right, by making the gate slightly more complicated, but without having to specify the error. And there are two general features here. One, that remember fault tolerances, as Daniel talked to you about, requires great precision of control. Requires control of about, well, the numbers don't mean that much, but typically we say 1 part per 10. And that sort of control is hard to come by experimentally. The other, and so we need to find a way of controlling the effects of the error building up as we go through the sequence. The other piece of it that is important to know is that this works because the error is the same in each of these gates. And so when we have errors that we would call incoherent, errors that appear over and over again with the same probability distribution, then provably you can remove the influence of those errors absolutely. So that even though I have an incoherent process, if I'm willing to make the gates complicated enough, I can completely remove that incoherence. And so if I took and said, the challenge here isn't that we have one value of epsilon. If we had one value of epsilon, then all we needed to do was to change the timing of this gate a little bit, and I could have found that process. The problem is that we have some ranges of epsilon. and that we want the gauge to be precise irregardless of what epsilon is, provided we have a promise that the epsilon is bounded by some range of errors. And those methods work. They can return the process to unitarity. So if I averaged over these errors and wrote out the density matrix for this gate, that would not be a unitary process. But for this, it would be much closer to unitary. And if you allow me to make this, to continue making this gate more complicated, we can get closer and closer to unitarity. We have a systematic way of creating those gates.
Yeah.
What is the second word from the trentetal?
Pulses.
Pulses.
Composite pulses. So the idea initially in magnetic resonance was take one pulse, replace it with a string of pulses, design it in such a way as to be more robust to the action. That this has been warped into approaches called strongly modulating pulses or optimal control theory, all aimed at achieving the same goal. And so there's a hierarchy of methods that we can apply. So have a look at that. Now, let me talk about, with this in mind, let me go back and look at this magnetic field gradient. Okay. So we had a LSN, which looked like you just need one spin. I just leave it at 60. That looked like this. It said that there was a spatially dependent magnetic field. And clearly, this is going to be a non-unitary process if we apply it to a state. And so let's say that we take, I need two coordinates now. I need time and position. Okay, so now that I'm going to describe the density matrix, I'm going to break it up into a continuum of density matrices. Okay. Describe the density matrix for every slice of our sample. Yeah?
Maybe it's just the same little logic, but why is it obvious that it's non-unitary?
Because I'm going to average over z. So this will be unitary, but when I average over z, it won't be.
Got it.
Thanks. Okay, so let's take the initial state to have no correlations, right? So rho zero of z is just the equilibrium state, okay? No correlations. And then we have the Hamiltonian, so rho t of z, that won't work. Let me take it to sigma x. Sorry. Should have a state that doesn't commute with Hamilton. Right, so here we're going to have a term e to the I gamma d z dz z t sigma z sigma x e to the minus I. And in all of these, I drop the factor of 2 again. Bigger factors of 2. Okay. This is easy enough to calculate, and so we'll end up with a transformation of sigma z. That will be gamma dbz dz z times t sigma x plus sine gamma dz dz z t signal to Y. And now it's convenient for me to define wave number K as gamma dBz dz times T. Yep.
Did you lose factor of two?
No, no.
Okay.
Now when you integrate it, there's no factor of two. You add the factor of two so that it actually integrates to this.
Okay,
sorry. Yeah, don't wait. I could do everything in spin operators and I could forget the factors of two. But here. Okay, so this term is a wave number. And what it describes is it describes the pitch of this helix of spin magnetization vectors. And so over here, if I have Z pointing up in the board, and I plotted the initial state of the magnetization, and then every orientation, every location along Z, the block vector will be pointing in the same direction, will be pointing along X. Over here, then what we would see is a helix of those vectors. Sorry that I can't draw, but something like that. And this wave number is the period of 1 over 2 pi over k is the period of that space of helix. Now you see what happens, that having wrapped the spins up into this helix, then if I describe the density matrix keeping this coordinate that describes the underlying distribution, then of course everything's unitary, nice unitary transformation. If, however, I take and define the density matrix for the entire system, then this is not unitary. And of course, what we would see if I choose some fixed piece is sink type behavior of magnetization vectors. Right. Now, this process, I don't want to call the coherence. And the reason is that we think of the coherence as loss of information. And in this case, no information has been lost, in fact. It's hidden from us because we're making a measurement over an ensemble and we're averaging. But it's just hidden by the averaging. And we can see this quite easily by carrying out this experiment. So if I turn on the magnetic field gradient, and the initial state is sigma z, and I'll make this into minus y pulse, so that the state here is sigma x, just as we have it over there. And let me plot over this experiment this value of k, right? Because k completely describes the spin dynamics, right? That k tells us the pitch of that helix. And we can see that k is just a linear function of time. Gamma is a constant. And if I set dBz dz to be a constant, then k is just a linear function of time. And it will start off at 0. So k equals 0, of course, is the case that there's no spatial modulation. K increases to some value. And we know exactly what that value is. That value is gamma dvz dz times time, the time that we've applied to Hall's state. What happens if I apply a pi pulse to this state here? And let me apply the pi pulse about the x-axis. Yeah.
Are we assuming we can apply that pi pulse exactly?
Yep.
Okay.
And since I have these composite pulses in fact, I can. And so that's the assumption. So what happens to this state? So if I apply a pi rotation about the x-axis, what does it do to the component of magnetization along the x-axis?
Flips it.
Nothing. They commute.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That's okay. What about for the y-axis? So that gets changed to negative time. And so if I apply a pi rotation, how does this helix change?
It becomes a right hand. Or
so it changes. Changes the helicity, but it doesn't change the wave number. Exactly as you said. And so pi pulse changes the sign of the wave vector. And then with time, under the same magnetic field, then this helix is going to unwind. And precisely at this time of where you have tau and tau, all of the magnetization comes back together. And at this point, we have an echo. It's called a spin echo. Even if you're not talking about spin, it's still called a spin echo. And what you've accomplished there is you remove the effect of static field and homogeneity. So regardless of what the error is in your system, as long as it's independent of time and along the z-axis, so any error that would add to delta omega here is removed by a spin echo. Okay. And this is used in all quantum processors to avoid small slow variations, small contributions of T2.
Yeah. So the first triangle that represents the error due to the Z inhomogeneous.
Right.
And by doing these two flips, we are going back to the zero, which is what we want.
Right. At this instant in time, you get back to having a system where everything is in phase.
Yeah. I'm a little worried about applying these pulses and wondering whether there's some Heisenberg type of uncertainty principle that you
can play on or. No. I don't see where your concern comes in, so explain this to me. I mean, is it an energy and time concern?
Right. That's basically
That's cool. We are so far away from that regime. You can convince yourself of it. right, so now we have a system that shows that we have incoherence. I wanted to put that up here. So we have incoherence in the Z operator. And by incoherence, I mean that there's an underlying distribution, but the distribution is static in time. Okay? And this can always be reposed. Now let's add to this form that really does look like decoherence. We have decoherence. Then what we expect is that there is some underlying process which is removing information from the system. What's the information in this case? The information is the spatial location and the phase of the magnetization. And they're perfectly correlated. Okay, so we're going to remove that piece. Since we're talking about liquid state NMR, we have a mechanism that easily removes that. And that's just molecular diffusion. So if I think about a liquid, it has a diffusion coefficient, and it's of order micron squared per millisecond for things like water. Okay, so a few microns squared per millisecond. And so if I was to describe the evolution of the system, and let me just take one component of this, because if I can describe what happens to sine wave, I can certainly describe what happens to the cosine wave. Okay, so let's just look at having magnetization. So let's call it rho t equal to cosine k naught z. So just k naught if I want some particular value of k. And well, let's plot it up, right? We have some magnetization as a function of z. And let's call this magnetization along the z axis. It won't make any difference. I'm not going to give any pulses. If I put it on the z-axis, it survives for a time t1. T1 is a long time. And that, of course, is 2 pi over k naught. Now, if I have molecular diffusion says that I have a random motion. It's not going to depend upon the spin state. Okay, so I can describe molecular diffusion as a Gaussian, so I can say that there's a probability of moving by delta z over a time t, and this is going to be given by a Gaussian. And sigma is equal to the square root of 2dt. Okay? And so if I wanted to calculate what the final magnetization is of this, then I would say, oh, well, okay, I've got this. I'm going to convolve it with this Gaussian. Okay? And you can see what's going to happen. Is that if I'm convolving it with a Gaussian, and if there's no boundaries, if I just have cosine over everywhere, then I can't change the periodicity of the helix, because whatever's coming in from the left is coming in from the right, and whatever's going to the left is going to the right. Okay? So simple central limit argument. You guys know the central limit theorem?
Yeah.
Good. So, let's calculate what we see for this case. And it's a little bit easier if I'll lose this stuff down here.
if we go to its Fourier representation, so if I take the Fourier transform with respect to z of a cosine function, then we have delta of k minus k naught plus delta of k plus k naught. You'll remember the Wiener-Kitchen theorem that says if I have a convolution in one space that's equivalent to multiplication by its Fourier conjugate, and the Fourier conjugate of a Gaussian is a Gaussian, and because I've normalized the Gaussian, then the Fourier transform, remember that the first k equals 0 point of the Fourier transform is the area of the probability distribution in this case, and the probability distribution of every one. So that's correctly normalized. And then we'll see that what the delta functions do, the delta functions are only going to sample this Gaussian. And so we'll end up with a Gaussian sampled at k naught. And nicely, I'll take the Fourier transform back to give me a result. And the answer is that we'll still have cosine k naught z. The delta function still exists. And e to the minus k naught squared sigma squared over 2 in this quantity is k minus k naught squared dt. Just substituting in for sigma squared. And so we have an attenuation of the signal that depends upon the wave number, and it depends upon the diffusion coefficient, and it depends upon time. And this is decoherence, right? Because I don't have any mechanism to tell the spins to go back to where they were at the beginning. Okay, so here we have decoherence. And it's useful to let me substitute back in again for k. So e to the minus k squared. Sorry, I dropped the square, right? So you have e to the minus gamma squared dbz dz squared time cubed times d. Right, that's the attenuation of the system. And so I can define T2. The inverse T2 is equal to gamma squared dBz dz squared d t squared. So let's look at this. This piece right here is the RMS field squared. So that says that I have T2, that piece. T2 is going to increase as we have a variation in some static field that we're applying. Here, this is the characteristic time. Remember that time here is defined exactly to be that interval of time. We're actually sampling an interval of time. So this is a characteristic time. And if I combine gamma into this, then that would be the RMS frequency squared. And so if I come back over here and I say, well, what is this value of T2 that's leading to decoherence? This value of T2 is equal to some frequency . So this is the frequency variation. This is the noise. The noise strength along the z-axis. And this is the correlation time of the noise. You can see what happens. The stronger the noise, the shorter T2. But the shorter the correlation time, the longer T2. Right? Because at the end, we're looking at an action. And if the noise is fluctuating too fast, we're going to average over it, and we'll see that it has no influence, even though it might be large. Yeah? And this is true for all two-level systems. All qubits have that same structure. Yeah?
Where do you have T squared?
I have T squared here because I have T cubed here, and I'm rewriting this. Thanks for the question. I'm rewriting this as e to the minus t over t2. Okay, I'm rewriting it as an exponential decay. So I'm going to keep t squared in the time constant. Okay. And you would say, well, why is it an exponential process? It's an exponential process because if I took this Gaussian and I said, let's take that Gaussian and make it into smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller time steps, we would see that the same thing happens. If I take a small time step, then I would have a narrower Gaussian. And if I looked out to twice a time step, I would have to then convolve with two of them, and the convolution of a Gaussian with itself is a Gaussian. Okay? So in fact, this is an exponential process to have the convolution of the Gaussian. Yeah.
My one question is because if you want to get a time constant and you're making a time constant dependent on time, how are you going to see that?
So here, the time constant doesn't depend upon time, it depends upon this characteristic time. And let me show you an example and see if I answer your question. Okay? Because you've asked exactly the right question here. And I'll answer it by showing this piece. I just want to save myself some room here, so I'm going to leave. There's a, the gradient is on at all times. So let's just keep the gradient on, and let's draw the cave picture. So it goes up, the pi pulse changes the helicity, and at tau, it crosses zero. Yeah? Okay, now we ask what happens if I run this faster. Okay. So now I'm going to put two pi pulses in the process. Okay? We're looking at the same sort of dynamic, except I'm saying, here I've changed the characteristic time. I've made the characteristic time half as long as it was before. If I draw the k-space picture in this case, what does it look like? So the first interval, it better look just like that, yeah? And then this one is going to invert it, and it better get back to there. It'll go through zero here. It'll get inverted again, and it'll come there. Now, immediately, you can see, let me draw this line on top of here. Right, this is the one from above. That's that case. And let me make this more bold so we can see that. Immediately you can see that by having an extra pi pulse, we've actually done something interesting. Because the attenuation, the T2, dependent upon k squared, right? And and here we've halved k, so it all looks really quite good. But let's calculate it explicitly and see. Now, before I calculate it explicitly, if you look at this process, what did I calculate? I calculated the attenuation for a cosine function by molecular diffusion. So what I need to do is to take this solution into integrate it over this path, right? Because here, the k vector is changing. There, the k vector is constant. So I'm just going to take that solution and integrate it. And it's an easy thing to do. All you end up is scaling the whole, the exponent by a third. Okay. Go ahead and do it. It comes in as k squared. K comes in as time squared. So the whole thing comes in easily. But this is the attenuation over this path. Over this path, it has to be exactly the same, right? Because it comes in as k squared. So the fact that we change the sign of k has no influence. And so the overall attenuation, so that's the signal loss, if you like, is equal to. It's not proportional. It's equal to that. Yeah? OK, here we see that we have, in this window, I have e to the minus k naught over 2 squared, right? Because k naught is still the same value. Yeah, d, now it's tau over 2, the whole thing divided by 3. And I have 4 switch periods, right? So we're going to just multiply that by 4. And that's the signal loss in this case. And now you can see that, okay, if I can get this right, e to the minus k naught squared d tau over 6. Right, and so we save the factor of 4 in the exponent by putting in twice the number of pulses. And as we put in more and more pulses, even though this process is decoherent, we're absolutely losing information. Because we can sample at shorter and shorter and shorter times, we can get closer and closer and closer to a unitary process. And so we can keep the information for longer and longer time. Okay, so that's what we want to see, that even a decoherent process, even a process which necessarily is losing information, we can still have control over it. We can still make it close to coherent. And how close? How close depends upon how many pulses we can put in. It depends upon this control parameter, omega 1. Yeah? Did I answer your question? OK, thanks. All right. Now we're going to stop here. Not only because we're out of time, but also because the next subject is one that Chris Wood wanted to see. So hopefully he'll be here tomorrow. But let me give you a problem. If you give 3 pulses, what you should be able to show me is that there are 5 such echoes out of 3 pulses. There's 5 times, if you draw the k vectors, that the k vectors will cross 0. And some of them are easy to see. There's one at the time tau after that pulse. And in fact, it's easy to show that any 2 pulses gives an echo. There's only a vanishingly small number of pulses that don't give an echo. 0 rotation. If I have a time tau after this, I get another echo. And this echo is very important. It's called the stimulated echo. The reason it's important is that during this time, the magnetization that leads to that echo is along the z-axis, so it's decaying by T1. And so it gives us a mechanism to store information. Remember that T1 is longer than T2, to store information for a long time. And then I get a whole slew. I get the other three echoes, showing where they come from. OK. Other questions? Well.